Major funding for The Pulse is provided by a leadership gift from the Sutherland Family Charitable Fund. The Sutherlands support WHYY and its commitment to the production of programs that improve our quality of life. And by Penn Medicine.
This is The Pulse, stories about the people and places at the heart of health and science. I'm Mike and Scott.
We went to bed, and just as we were going to sleep, he pulled out a gun, pointed it to my temple, put his finger on the trigger, and then put a pillow on it and lay down and said, "This is so you don't go anywhere in the middle of the night. I'm tired of you leaving me."
A gun can change a relationship, a family, a life.
My leg went offline. It was like a cord being taken out of a TV. I tumbled, I took a hard fall, and I realized that I was unable to move my legs.
A gun can protect you.
I got out one of my guns and loaded it, and I lay there, really sick with anxiety. I'm very, very glad that I had that gun.
Guns are part of many people's identity.
A gun culture, or whatever you want to call it, it's a faith, it's a religion.
A gun can make you feel safe.
I have absolutely crossed to the point where I am willing to use force to defend myself and my loved ones.
When we talk about guns in America, we usually end up fighting, getting into heated arguments about policy and politics. We're not going to do that on this episode of The Pulse. Instead, we're going to hear stories about the difference a gun makes. Like a catalyst in a chemical reaction, a gun can set things in motion. It can intensify situations and cause a chain of events that cannot be undone. Has a doctor ever asked you whether you own a gun? My kid's pediatrician asks about this every time, but that's it. None of my other doctors has ever asked about it. Some physicians are calling on their colleagues to make these conversations more routine. They say asking about guns can save a life. Is the gun locked? Who has access to it? Are you depressed? But bringing up firearms in a doctor's office can be tricky, and whether physicians end up going there or not really depends on the circumstances. Alana Gordon talked to different kinds of doctors who are working through these conversations with their patients.
To start things off, I reached out to Sarah Noble. She's a psychiatrist at Einstein Health in North Philadelphia. A lot of people she sees are dealing with trauma. Recently, she had an experience with one of her patients where firearms came up.
I think she just came in and let me know, you know, "Dr. Noble, I think I'm going to get a gun so that I can protect myself because I don't feel safe. You know, there's all sorts of dangerous people out there."
Sarah worried about whether a firearm would make the situation safer for this particular patient, who had experienced trauma and was feeling especially mistrustful of the risk of another violent act happening to her.
The statistics show that a gun is much more likely to be used against a woman than it would be to protect a woman, whether that's by someone in the home, an intimate partner, or whether it's by a perpetrator. So I pulled up the data to show her that.
You literally went on your computer?
Uh-huh. Yeah, I went on my computer to pull up the data to show her so that she could see that. And once she saw it, she, you know, felt convinced that it actually wouldn't necessarily make her feel safer, but could actually be a dangerous thing to have in the house. And so we brainstormed a little bit about what might be something that could help her feel safe, and talked about perhaps instead she could get a baseball bat, because that way she could keep it by her bed. And so if she found that someone actually came into her house, she would have a weapon, but it was a much less dangerous weapon.
As a psychiatrist, Sarah has a close relationship with her patients. They talk about stuff, intimate stuff. But the conversations can be totally different for, say, geriatricians or emergency room docs. Rachel Dawkins is a pediatrician in St. Petersburg, Florida.
So I had a 4-year-old little girl who came in for a checkup late last week after she had gotten done with school and mom got off of work. And She was wearing little cowboy boots and a pink tutu dress and cute as could be. She was very talkative and adorable.
Rachel goes through a bunch of routine questions with the girl. Does she wear a seatbelt? Does she brush her teeth? And then she gets to this one.
And then I asked her what she would do if she saw a gun. And she gave a very surprising answer, which was,
I'd kill someone.
You know, I probably had a smirk on my face, which was contrasted to Mom's open mouth, shocked look. She pretty much sat there dumbfounded. And then, you know, counseled the child about, no, we wouldn't touch the gun. We wouldn't hurt anybody with a gun. Of course you wouldn't do that. And the child said, oh, no, I wouldn't do that. She quickly recanted her first answer. I wasn't so much in shock because about half of the kids that age will say something like, I'd kill someone or I'd shoot it or, you know, pick up the gun. And I think it really goes to show that kids don't have the ability to tell real versus toy or real versus fake.
I don't know.
So I asked the mom if the guns were typically stored, you know, out of reach of the child, locked with the ammunition separately, and she said that they are, and typically that the guns are kept away from the child, but she had witnessed them cleaning the guns the week before. I think it was a good learning opportunity for both mom and kid. Of course, there's uncomfortable conversations surrounding any topic that we bring up in the office, but especially with guns, sometimes parents can feel that they're being singled out because they're gun owners, but that's really not the case. We're just talking about gun safety and safe gun storage.
A lot of doctors can feel like they're on their own navigating these situations. Firearms never came up in medical training for Emmy Betts. She works in the ER in Denver, Colorado, and says, training aside, these can be challenging conversations.
But I think there's a lot of other barriers as well. You know, fear of alienating patients or offending them, not knowing what to do with the information and so forth.
Emmy thinks doctors need to do better at understanding guns and gun culture to better connect with and counsel patients. She says she doesn't own guns and for most of her life didn't know much about them.
I would say I'm a very proud Westerner, but didn't grow up in a household with guns. We spend a lot of time in the mountains, but mostly hiking and cross-country skiing, and I've never been hunting.
So Emmy wrote an editorial in the Journal of the American Medical Association, calling on doctors, including herself, to get more comfortable. Shortly after, Emmy got an unusual response from a guy who would take her efforts in a totally new direction.
I met Michael in August of 2015.
And I agree with Emmy that we met in August of 2015.
That is Michael Viktoroff, and he has a different relationship with guns.
I shoot competitive pistol and a high-power rifle. You know, I have a couple of AR-15s. I shoot shotgun like an amateur, just for fun, blowing up clays. That's fun.
Michael is a certified NRA firearms instructor. He gets annoyed with what he sees as a growing rift about firearms in our country, with conversations becoming hyper-political. But he's also a doctor, a family physician. So as he says, he's got his feet in these two worlds. Emmy's article resonated with him. And somewhat conveniently, he is based near her in Colorado. So Michael reaches out.
I guess I started maybe with an email. You know, I didn't want to be too brazen, right?
And he says, hey, I'm on board with what you wrote. But if you're serious about this, I have a proposal for you.
Look, I have this pistol class.
Take my class.
Well, I'll give you a certificate of completion at the end. We'll do through the whole thing, you know, the bona fide NRA, no kidding, pistol class. But in addition, we're going to talk about how does this come across to you as a health professional.
I was excited, but really nervous.
So in the fall of that same year, Emmy and a small group of doctors met up one weekend at a community center to take his 8-hour class.
So the first goal is to set everyone in the room at complete ease, especially me, that no bullet is ever going to come out of a gun here. They're all empty. And then we can bring lots of guns, you know, many different sizes and shapes and types, and we can all play.
I was very surprised at how many kinds of guns there are and, like, the differences. I think I just had never really thought about that angle, and that for some people it's sort of a hobby in that sense. The mechanics of it are kind of interesting.
And then after a few hours in the community center, they went to the range.
We're going to shoot some bullets. We're going to go to the gun range. We're going to put bullets into a gun. We're going to fire them. They're going to make holes in paper. And you're going to see what that feels like, because actually that is emotionally and intellectually at the same time the whole point of crossing that chasm.
I did not like it. Like, it was really an uncomfortable experience.
Emmy worried something might go wrong, like that someone might accidentally shoot her.
And I realize that's irrational, probably, but that was sort of in the back of my head, that it felt like an inherently sort of dangerous thing to do for fun. It's also sort of loud, and you have to wear earplugs and then headphones, and so it's like your senses feel sort of dulled.
Still, Emmy says she is really glad she went through it, the whole course.
I haven't changed probably my own views on whether I'll ever own a gun or not, but I think it really helped me understand, like, okay, I get why people go to the range for fun with their friends and enjoy target shooting or competitive shooting and so forth. It really helped me cross the bridge.
Emmy says she keeps her pistol certificate in a drawer in her office as a reminder. It's mixed in with some empty shell casings from that first trip to the range. So do you think more physicians should be trained in this sort of thing? Go through what you went through.
I do think that physicians and other healthcare providers need more training, at least the sort of classroom portion. I don't think they need the full 8-hour NRA course.
Emmy is trying to figure out what type of training and approach would be most effective so that doctors can get more comfortable bringing this topic up more routinely with patients. She's teamed up with Michael, and they've since held 3 more pistol classes for doctors and psychologists.
Today was exciting for me in that it brought together a bunch of different groups. So
they recently piloted a modified training for about 20 ER doctors in Colorado.
What I really hope comes from today is that the physicians who are here on their next shift talk to the patients who are at risk of firearm violence, that they don't feel as nervous about bringing up topics.
When she's not leading these trainings, Emmy is doing a lot of other research on firearms. She's now looking into how doctors handle this with patients who have dementia or some kind of cognitive impairment. Michael Viktoroff, the pistol instructor who's also a family physician, is older and doesn't see patients anymore. But he still thinks a lot about the discussions he used to have and didn't have inside the exam room over the years.
I have to confess that I'm just learning, you know, now, this decade, about the conversations I should have been having with patients of mine years past who killed themselves. It's never the one you suspect. If I had been a little smarter 10 or 20 years ago when, you know, a 24-year-old woman I was working with who, by the way, did not seem the least bit depressed, but she had, you know, issues she was struggling with. I was working with her. Make a long story short, she killed herself. There's a statistic that a large number of people who end up killing themselves have visited their primary care doctor within a very short period of time, about a week, a month, before they do it.
These moments, he says, are vital opportunities to counsel patients to help keep them and their firearms safe.
I feel for sure I would be able to save a life or two that escaped me in the past.
That story was reported by Alana Gordon. We're talking about guns on The Pulse today, and the physician we just heard from, he talked about the role doctors can play in preventing suicides. Guns are used in half of all suicides in the United States. Jessie Wright Mendoza grew up in a home where her grandfather kept a gun, and even after Jessie was diagnosed with bipolar disorder as a teenager, which put her at high suicide risk, the gun stayed. Looking back, Jessie says her grandfather's decision seems reckless. She is 32 now. Her grandfather is 92. Jessie called him up to ask him why he kept the gun.
Hello.
Hey, it's me. I talk to my grandfather pretty much every day. His name is Keith Wright, but I call him Grandpa. We talk a lot about the news. And after the high school shooting in Parkland, Florida, our conversation turned to guns.
Do you think that people who keep guns in their house are safer or less safe?
Safer.
Why?
Because they have a way to defend themselves. If I didn't think it was safer, there'd been no reason for me to keep guns in the house.
Wait, can I ask you a serious question?
Yes.
Why do you keep a gun next to your bed, but you don't arm the security alarm?
Because if we set the security alarm, movement at night will trigger it.
But that sounds crazy, though. But look, what are you gonna shoot somebody?
I would shoot somebody if they threaten my family. Yes, it's the period between the time the police get here and the invasion that the guns are for.
First you're gonna turn on the lights on, and then you're going to go find the ammunition that you keep somewhere else. I'm befuddled by this entire arrangement.
My grandpa's always kept the gun unloaded, with the ammo in a separate place, but it still frightened me when I stumbled across the revolver in his nightstand one day while I was playing hide and seek. I was 8 at the time. The gun looked cold and smooth there in the bottom drawer. I stared at it for a minute, expecting it to come up and bite me. I never liked it, but having a gun in the house really started to bother me after I was diagnosed with bipolar disorder. I was 17 when I experienced my first real episode of soul-crushing depression. That was the first time I thought about killing myself. Not long after, I turned 18, and I spent 7 weeks in a psychiatric hospital.
It made me super uncomfortable that it didn't occur to you to, like, not keep a gun in the house when I was suicidal. That just sounds totally out of character for you.
No, that's not true. My reason for not getting rid of them then is I put trigger locks on the guns. I put most of the guns in a lock cabinet. And I separated the ammo from the guns, and I thought that was adequate.
My mom and my grandpa, who raised me, had no experience with mental illness. And I hid the fact that I'd been carving deep cuts into my arms from the doctors so that they'd release me from the hospital.
I remember asking the psychiatrist, how do you know when somebody's bipolar? And he said to me, we give them medicine for bipolar. If it makes them better, we call them bipolar. I think he thought it was funny.
I started talking about suicide barely 24 hours after leaving the hospital. And knowing where the gun was didn't help. I thought it would be so easy.
So when I was coming home from the hospital, what did you feel like your responsibilities were? Did you think that I would ever hurt myself worse? Or that I would try to kill myself?
Based on my knowledge of you and knowing you, I didn't think you would. I considered the risk of you using the gun was less than the risk of being unable to protect the family in case of an intrusion.
I think
that's the duty of a father of a family. Of the leader of the family, one of his first things is to provide safety.
My grandpa and I didn't come to any kind of big resolution or agreement after talking on the phone. I think he misjudged and maybe even downplayed the risk I was to myself, and how a firearm in the house made the situation even more dangerous. And maybe I've underestimated his need to keep me safe, in the way that he thought was best.
We wouldn't trade you for anybody. I was hooked to the day you were born and you called me Grandpa.
I did not call you Grandpa the day I was born.
It sure as hell sounded like it.
That's reporter Jesse Wright Mendoza talking to her grandfather, Keith Wright. Guns are often wrapped up in a person's identity. That's why conversations about them tend to get so heated. Our next two stories speak to this issue of identity. A couple of years ago, a gun shop owner in Maryland agreed to sell a new gun that was coming on the market, a so-called smart gun. That decision attracted the wrath of many of his customers and gun right advocates from around the country. Alan Yu has the story.
Andy Raymond is tall, he has a beard, he drives a black pickup truck, and he likes guns.
I'm an American. Every American should be into guns, as far as I'm concerned.
For him, guns are for sport, for self-defense, and little bits of history. He picks up one of his rifles.
So this is a Finnish Valmet. So it's there's a long story behind it. The Finns fought the Winter War against the Russians. Okay, it's super smooth, it runs like a Cadillac, but fires the same round as the AK, and it takes AK mags. So the whole point is, you could kill a Russian, take the magazines off of him, and resupply, okay?
He sells guns from other countries, and 4 years ago, a German company got in touch and asked Andy if he would sell one of their guns.
I'm for any gun. You want to go out get a hunting rifle? Get a hunting rifle. You want to go get an AR-15? Get one. Good for you, buddy. Go out there, shoot, practice it. It's a skill.
The German company was selling this personalized gun. Some people call it a smart gun. That means it comes with a little watch that's an anti-theft device. If you're not wearing the watch when you hold the gun, you can't shoot it. The idea is that only the gun owner can fire this gun. A criminal can't use it. A child can't fire it by accident. Andy took this gun to the range to try it out. But the company didn't have the right kind of ammunition, and the gun jammed easily.
So, obviously they're not gun people, are they?
That gave Andy pause. It made him think these people weren't about selling guns. This was not a gun for gun people. It was a bit of a red flag, but Andy's thinking was maybe this is a way to get anti-gun people interested in guns.
Gets people shooting. Gets people to the range. Then when you're at the range, you talk to other people. You shoot their stuff. See what you like, all right? So it gets people who normally wouldn't be involved in guns, gets them actually involved.
But here's the other thing about this personalized gun. A few states over, in New Jersey, there was a long-time law sitting on the books that said that once the smart gun technology becomes available, the state of New Jersey will eventually forbid any gun shop owner from selling a handgun that's not a smart gun. When word got out that Andy in Maryland was selling this gun, the gun rights people didn't like it. And so they did not like Andy.
Then everybody started calling. I mean, I got about maybe 4,000 phone calls and emails in a day. Pick up the phone, and it was just somebody screaming, "You're a piece of shit." Da da da. You hang up the phone, and it rings as you hang it up, and you pick it up again, and hey, screw you, and you hang it up and pick it up again. Firearm rights, the gun culture, or whatever you want to call it, it's a faith, it's a religion. And, you know, you've got your rabbis and your imams and your priests of this faith. And, you know, if they identify a heretic, a blasphemer, you're going to be punished.
These were Andy's people, gun people. But suddenly, Andy was afraid someone would break into his shop and cause trouble. He spent the night behind his desk with a gun, cigarettes, and booze. Later, he decided it wasn't worth it and changed his mind. He made it known that he would not sell the smart gun. But the damage was done. Andy built his business reputation partly on building custom rifles.
So it's just pretty much a box of parts. So like you can see here, there's all this.
There's a workshop above the store.
And good to go.
But the flare-up over the smart gun hurt Andy's business.
We had customers that I've never seen again after that. When I run into people, that's what they know me by. I was known as a staunch Second Amendment advocate. Now everybody thinks that I'm some sort of progressive hipster. I'm some kind of anti-gun gun dealer.
That was back in 2014. The hubbub has mostly died down now.
Like I said, and I say this repeatedly, I'd rather be shot by the thing than sell it again. Want no part of it.
That story was reported by Alan Yu. For many people, a gun is part of their identity. The guy in Alan's story kept using the term gun people. They are hunters, target shooters. Maybe they used to be in the military. And for some, a gun is a way to feel safe in their identity.
I'm a non-binary trans person. I use the they, them, theirs pronouns. I also identify as queer or pansexual.
That's Laura McSpadden, a reluctant gun owner.
I'm located in Rochester, New York. I'm a strength coach and performing strength artist.
What is a strength artist?
So it's like someone who in another generation or decade would have run away with the circus. I do things like bend steel bars and open horseshoes, and I can break a Louisville Slugger bat with my body. You know, normal hobbies.
So you don't really need a gun then. But Laura does have a gun.
I have a Mossberg 500 pump action shotgun.
This would probably be a major surprise to Laura's former self. You, for a long time in your life, identified as a pacifist.
Absolutely. So I was raised, my father is a practitioner of Zen Buddhism. I was raised in a home where what it meant to be nonviolent, what it meant to honor the first precept of I resolve not to kill but to cherish all life was a frequent topic of discussion. That sort of understanding that we are all connected, that to harm another being is to harm oneself. And I took that on I have described it somewhat, only partially jokingly, as being a militant pacifist.
A few years ago, Laura took a self-defense class in Boston, and the trainer said to the class, the fact that you're here means you're willing to use force to defend yourself.
Already, like, that kind of, like, struck me, and I'm like, wait, is that true for me? And I think one of the factors was actually processing my own internalized homophobia and transphobia. Parts of me had taken on those beliefs of bullies, particularly in the 80s and 90s in Indiana, where I grew up. I think to a degree it was very easy for me to believe that I was not worth standing up for.
And then the self-defense trainer asked some tough questions, like, at what point are you willing to use force to defend yourself?
Is it if there's a threat to you but not your property, or to your loved ones but not yourself? Like, what is that line? And then as a follow-up, how much force is it that you are willing to use? And that kind of like lingered with me and sat with me in my discomfort of something had shifted in me and I didn't know how far it had shifted or to where.
All of these questions were on Laura's mind. And then after the 2016 election, Laura says it felt like there was more hostility toward LGBTQ people. In Rochester, New York, rainbow flags were burned. At a karaoke bar in a nearby town, a man was beaten while people yelled homophobic slurs at him. Laura felt ready for a next step in self-defense.
Several of my friends and community members got together and joined a gun club solely for LGBTQ people.
This was the first time Laura touched a gun.
It felt very unfamiliar. It was a very surreal sort of moment.
And then when did you learn, how did you learn how to shoot?
So we started going to a firing range that was actually on the property of one of our members. And, you know, my experience with having a nearly lifelong meditation practice really helped. That sort of aha moments of recognizing this too is a mindfulness practice. This too connects to my breath. This too is you know, about precision and patience and beginner's mind.
Was there something that stood out to you about the experience? I've only, I think, shot a gun once, and I remember just being stupidly surprised by how loud it was. But was there something, I guess I should have anticipated that.
They are loud.
So what were some things that sort of were weird or you were like, huh, that's interesting?
Even though, like, you know, you hear about kickback, you hear about, you know, how much force they carry, I was surprised at how much of my ability to brace and stabilize I needed to use in order to remain present for that moment when the gun goes off. It's not only loud, it's forceful. I mean, it wasn't something that was overwhelming or knocked me on my butt, but it was this, you know, even deeper level of, holy cow, these are things not to be messed with. This is something else.
Now that the gun is in your house, how has that made you feel? Do you feel any different?
I still very much live in the gray area when it comes to guns. I'm grateful that I am learning how to shoot it. I'm not always happy that it exists there. I have absolutely crossed to the point where I am willing to use force to defend myself and my loved ones.
Laura McSpadden lives in Rochester, New York, and is co-founder of the queer and trans gun club Trigger Warning. Lately, the word we usually hear after gun is violence. We've heard from people on this episode who say they have guns to protect themselves against violence or to prevent it. But our next two stories are about guns causing violence. Women in abusive relationships are 5 times more likely to die when their abuser owns a gun. Renee Norris-Jones was in a violent marriage for years. Then, when her husband brought home a gun, everything changed. Nina Feldman has Renee's story, and just a note, it includes some graphic descriptions.
Renee met Carlton at a Philadelphia bus stop in 1974. She was 16 years old with a toddler. He was good-looking, and she was charmed by him. They started dating, and once she was 18, got married. Carlton taught her how to wear makeup and find the right slip to go under a dress. As a young woman living away from home, she just found those things helpful.
We were 2 years into the relationship before I saw anything.
It was a Friday night.
It was date night. I was almost finished getting ready. I was finishing up makeup in the mirror. He was sitting this on the side of the bed, and we were discussing dinner. Do we want Chinese? I had that for lunch. What about French? What about this? And to me, it was as easy as that. And I woke up on the floor. It was as easy as that. There wasn't an argument. He knocked me out.
After that, the violence became regular. Sometimes Renee would call the police, but often they didn't show up. And when they did, they weren't much help. Renee remembers one time in particular. It was 1976, and she'd just filed for a restraining order, which were brand new at the time. Carlton came home, and Renee called the police because he was violating the restraining order. When they got there, Renee says her husband began to beat her, right there in front of the police. Even as he did it, she was hoping the restraining order would mean something.
I'm holding onto this paper for dear life, and it's fanning in the wind, because if he looks at this paper, he's going to see that some judge signed this and said, this man can no longer hit me. And this man is beating me like he is in the ring. And I'm watching this police officer, and he is cleaning his nails, going, Mr. Jones, please take your hands off of your wife. And the officer waits for him to catch his breath. Must have walked him to the corner and back, because they weren't going that long, and came back and said, y'all have a good night now. And I'm showing him the paper, y'all have a good night.
Sometimes after Carlton would beat her, Renee would go stay in a women's shelter. But she says they were often full, and when there was room, you were only allowed to stay for a week. Once her time was up, she would go home, where Carlton would inevitably hit her again. Her finances were wrapped up with his, and she depended on him. He was abusing her children, too, and she was afraid for their safety. Renee did go to her family for help.
At some point, I showed up at my dad's house, just busted lip, black eyes, just totally messed up. I'm telling him all the things that I'm going through, and he looked at me and said, "What did you think marriage was?" And this was my father, this was my hero. So that totally screwed me up. Like, I used to think that I was a fool for all the times I left.
Eventually, it got so bad she decided she did need to leave town. She moved to Houston, got a job, and for a while, things were going well. But soon, her father called and told her,
"Okay, you guys had your little separation. You need to get back together with your husband." My family loves this man. They love this man. It's like Cheers when Norm comes in. Oh my God, they love this man.
Finally, Renee gave in. Carlton moved in with her in Houston. And she says as soon as he got there, the cycle of abuse started up again. And then one night, everything changed.
We went to bed, and just as we were going to sleep, he pulled out a gun, pointed it to my temple, put his finger on the trigger, and then put a pillow on it and lay down and said, "This is so you don't go anywhere in the middle of the night. I'm tired of you leaving me."
Renee didn't sleep that night. She'd been planning to leave again. She found a roommate, and they'd already rented an apartment across town. She'd just been waiting for the right moment to move.
It just sent me to a different place, and I just was like, I'm out. It was 7 years of hell. But the magnitude of all of those years together and the gun were equal. So the next day when I went to work, I called my roommate and said, "He brought home a gun. I gotta leave tonight."
Renee and her roommate packed her things.
I said, "I've got to take this gun. He's gonna be pissed when he comes home and I'm not here. He's gonna come looking for me." So we picked up this gun. The two of us picked it up like it was a delicate egg. And we carried it out and put it on the back of the truck.
The gun stayed in a shoebox at the bottom of Renee's linen closet in her new apartment. And Carlton never found her. After about a year and a half, Renee wanted a divorce. And that meant she had to get back in touch with Carlton.
So I tracked him down. And we signed the divorce papers. And he said, "Sure, you give me my gun back."
Renee didn't like this plan, but she was willing to do whatever it took to get his signature. So she agreed, and she pulled the gun out of its hiding place.
So I sat on the floor, and I took this gun apart. And every little tiny piece, I don't care how small, I took with tape and newspaper and wrapped up every tiny piece, every bullet separately.
Renee stuffed all the bulky, individually wrapped gun parts into a few shopping bags. She'd picked a pretty fancy place for lunch with lots of wait staff. She set out for the restaurant.
And I got there first. I had a nice lunch. He came in, and he was like, "Oh, I see you started with that." I mean, "Oh, no, I'm finished." He said, "You brought the gun?" I said, "I did." And he probably thought I went shopping. That's it. It's in the bag. I have it.
Carlton signed the divorce papers. Renee got up to leave.
As I was walking away, I glimpsed over my shoulder, and he was looking at all of the bags and looking at me. And he said something like, "You really don't trust me," or something. "Or you, what did you think I was going to do?" And I didn't even wait to hear. I just was, just walk, walk, walk. Don't let them see you sweat. Once I turned that corner, I was gone.
A few years later, it was 1984, and Renee got a phone call from a friend who told her that Carlton's mother had been found murdered in her home by her son.
And my first thought was, oh my God, that could have been me.
Carlton was convicted of first-degree murder. He died in prison in 2015. Renee is doing well. She's still in therapy, and she tells her story to people around the country as an advocate for women in abusive relationships. She recently completed her PhD and is now Dr. Norris Jones.
That was Nina Feldman reporting. We're talking about the difference a gun makes. For Jermaine McCory, a gun almost ended his life. He was 22 years old when he was shot. At the time, he was dealing drugs. He was on a corner when a man came walking toward him. Jermaine realized this guy was coming his way and started to run. The other guy started to shoot.
It was like an out-of-body experience. It was like my brain shut down. I realized I was running as fast as I could. And while I was running, I was feeling my body to see if I was shot. And I don't feel anything penetrating. So it was just this feeling of happiness, you know? And I'm like, wow, I made it. They didn't get me. But a split second after that euphoric feeling, it was like my leg went offline. It was like a cord being taken out of a TV. I tumbled, I took a hard fall, and I realized that I was unable to move my legs. So I was laying on the ground. I knew I was shot, but I just didn't know where. I looked down, I felt my body, and there was blood near my right kidney area, and I realized that I was shot through my abdomen. My thoughts started to spiral out of control. You know, could this be the end? Before they resuscitated me and put me to sleep, I just grabbed the EMS's hand and I just asked them nicely, "Don't let me die tonight."
My name's Ted Corbin. I'm an emergency medicine physician, and I see gunshot wounds almost every time I work in the emergency department, at least probably one person a day. There's a dedicated place where we care for patients that have suffered gunshot wounds. It's called the trauma bay. There's no other way to describe it other than organized chaos to take care of this individual, and it's pretty fascinating to watch.
Ted was not Jermaine's doctor. The two work together now in a gun violence prevention program. But like Ted says, he sees these kinds of injuries all the time.
You know, the first thing that we need to do with such an extensive injury, anything that's on the trunk of the body, we want to control bleeding, ensure breathing. So it's airway, breathing, and circulation. ABCs, those are the most important things that we live by. There's this spectrum of bleeding that can occur where, in some instances, we see no blood. The extreme opposite of that is there are pools of blood. You can imagine, you know, stepping in a puddle of water when it's raining like crazy. It's the same type of feeling when there's someone who's bleeding quite a bit. Gunshot wounds look like a puncture wound. Very small, but that small wound that you see on the surface, the damage it can do is unbelievable. It's devastating. I mean, and if I remember correctly, Jermaine was shot in the stomach.
Yeah, the bullet went through my stomach and it severed an artery near my spine.
Can I see the back? I'm sorry. I don't think I ever asked you that, but oh, wow. So what's interesting is how bullets travel inside a body. So it went in on the right side of his body, but came out on the left side of his body. And looking at where the exit wound is, it's really close to his spine. So he's really, really lucky.
The next thing I remember was waking up at the hospital. And I woke up to see my little sister at my bedside. And I looked down and I saw that my hands were strapped to the bed. You know, there's a tube going down my throat. I feel like I can't breathe. There's a bunch of mucus, you know, trapped. I realized that there were staples. I realized that there were bandages on both of my legs, and there was scars on both sides.
But the injuries go beyond the physical wounds. Jermaine and Ted work for a program called Healing Hurt People that helps victims of gun violence cope with the emotional fallout. Most of their clients come from Philadelphia neighborhoods where gun violence is rampant. Here's Ted.
The gunshot wound is is, you know, incredibly traumatizing in of itself, in that you have you've been hurt. You compound the other issues of, you know, exposure to violence, poverty, racism, classism, all those, you know, insults, and then you have this gunshot wound. It's a lot to manage. There's a lot that's layered on to that. And so am I not getting the appropriate pain medications because I'm a person of color? Am I not being referred to additional resources because I don't have insurance? What do I do?
Well, the emotional trauma that I was dealing with, you know, after the shootings was, am I going to be safe when I go home? You know, how am I going to survive now? I was in a hospital for about a month. The thing I remember most about those days was sitting in my bed reflecting on what I was going to do with my future, and a lot of boredom. It was a long recovery process. Give or take, it took about a year. I have nerve damage in my right leg. Throughout the years, I've gotten it stronger to where I'm able to walk with a steady gait. But I have pain in my lower back pretty frequently. There's pain throughout my knee, my leg. The nerves definitely give me a sign that they're not fully healed yet. Trauma affects the body. Trauma is in the body. So when you go back to a story or an experience, those same feelings and those sensations, you know, they arise because the body remembers. It stores everything.
And when those feelings come back, how do you manage it?
What I do to cope and manage in the moment is I do deep breathing exercises. I pay attention to my body a lot. I'll realize that, you know, I'm sweating, my heart is beating, I'm not really breathing as much. So, okay. I wonder to myself, why am I thinking about this? And I just say to myself, I'm at my house, I'm safe. This is why, you know, I do the work, you know, to help individuals who've gone through these experiences. This is what I do.
Jermaine McCoury and Ted Corbin are part of Healing Hurt People, a program that works with victims of gun violence. Liz Tung produced this piece. Poet and pediatrician Iran Macha wrote a poem after the murder of Jordan Davis, an unarmed black teenager who was killed by an irate white man following a dispute at a gas station.
Our Boy, for Jordan Davis, Renisha McBride, Trayvon Martin, Ayanna Stanley Jones, Tamir Rice, Michael Brown, etc. It's 2 years now our boy's been gone. 2 years since the brightness closed. Our boy was bright. If you could have seen him, he would have burned straight through your retinas into your brain, passed down the blood vessels in your neck, into your heart. You couldn't help smiling at our boy. They said those blood vessels are what the bullet blew out, lead dynamite going off in the dark tunnel that carried life all through his body. No train could pass through the wreckage, the system amok. They say first your heart beats faster and then your breath picks up, trying to make the difference, but nothing undoes a mountain quicker than an explosion. You can go down the hill behind our house where our boy used to play and cross the muddy creek and fight the brambles until the woods give way to an open field. Beyond it, you'll see the bald skulls of mountains. Some men find nothing sacred, not even their mother. Some will kill because it's their inheritance. Our boy was bright. brighter than anything could be pulled from a mine, our boy was the mountain. It's been years since anything sacred was respected. Blasting through that child's vessels must have been nothing, but then you know nothing of how we made them. Putting our love into a big mixing bowl and stepping aside so the earth could work through us. The most sacred work we ever did. The brightness burst out of us, and we thought this was finally a light that would never turn off, even though we went to bed every night with prayers between our teeth. If you could have seen our boy, I swear, it might have put the pieces back in place. It might have closed the circle. We might have been safe all together.
Poet and pediatrician Iran Macha reading Our Boy. That's our show for this week. The Pulse is a production of WHYY in Philadelphia. Our health and science reporters are Alana Gordon, Irina Zhorov, Alan Yu, and Liz Tung. Our intern is Mike Mascarelli. Charlie Kyer is our engineer. Alex Stern is our associate producer. Tanya English is our editorial director. I'm Mike and Scott. Thank you for listening.
Behavioral health reporting on The Pulse is supported by the Thomas Scattergood Behavioral Health Foundation, an organization that is committed to thinking, doing, and supporting innovative approaches in integrated health care. Penn Medicine supports The Pulse. Some of us live for the future, but what if tomorrow is too late? That's why today at Penn Medicine, their breakthroughs are helping to change lives. Healthy cells can now find and eliminate cancer cells. Focused ultrasound is taking the place of brain surgery to correct essential tremor. And vision is being restored using a genetic treatment. That's why your life is worth Penn Medicine. Learn more at PennMedicine.org.
Ben Franklin Technology Partners of Southeastern Pennsylvania supports WHYY's The Pulse and are partners with a purpose, providing capital, counsel, and connections to technology entrepreneurs and investors in the greater Philadelphia area. More about Ben at PartnersWithAPurpose.org. Independence Blue Cross supports WHYY's The Pulse. Independence is coming to your neighborhood to help you understand healthcare options. Licensed agents can help prepare you for whatever may be ahead. Learn more at ibx.com/events. Independence Blue Cross. Live fearless.